I've been thinking the detective's insane. In the movies and the airport bestsellers, I mean, what does the detective ever achieve? A case walks into his office, he follows the trail, he's chased, beaten, shot, and left for dead, but he keeps following the trail. And when he gets to its end, what? Someone goes to prison or ends up dead, and he goes back to his office and has a drink. And the city keeps churning, bringing up new evils to walk through the door and send him down the next trail on the next loop. The detective is insane. The detective is Sisyphus, rolling that boulder up the hill. All right, I tried to bring that in, guys, as much seriousness of Dan Waters' words. Hello, welcome to another episode of Outside the Pages. We are in our second week of our Pac Nadel and Dan Waters double feature. And we are talking about two great books today, two books that to me are deconstructions of the detective story. I didn't really want to call it that because I feel like Alex will misquote us when he's on in 2 weeks and be like, it wasn't actually that. You're looking too much into it, but that's how these books feel to me. We have a very special guest today. So we'll introduce her first, Elle, who is not exactly legit on Twitter. Thank you for coming on to talk about these books.
Thank you.
Yeah, we've been wanting to jam for you with you for a while, and it was a lot of fun listening to you on Pink Buzz. Johnny did request a shout out on this episode, so we're gonna shout out Johnny quick. Johnny, we love you, Johnny.
Get out of the way.
I do love Johnny, and I'm really excited for him to come on for Pac Nadel's episode in a couple weeks. He's super nervous, which I was super nervous the first time we interviewed Pac Nadel, but he breaks the ice so easy. We have our Dan episode coming up on Sunday, and I'm incredibly fucking nervous. So. I'm really hoping Dan is like Alex and just starts talking about random insanity like the London Underground.
Yeah.
I really hope it's really easy, and I hope that we...
We were all nervous as hell, and then he was on for like... We had like a four-hour discussion of just goofing off. Anyway, let's hop in.
Alex is a great guest, but yeah, let's dig into L, because I want to comment. I want to comment on how great your username is. Because as Michael was reading you in, I was like, well, that's not very... She's definitely legit.
Oh, see that? I built myself in a backdoor in case what I say is wrong. Or it's not necessarily, you know, what something is. And it's like, well, I never said that I was exactly, you know, correct on anything, so...
Right. I love it. It's almost... It's got like that Whose Line Is It Anyway intro, too. Like, just the way that he was like, L, not exactly legit. And I was like, oh, man.
Calling me a liar. That's off so the perfect. Top.
Yeah, I was like, geez. I'm ready to hear what she thinks about these books. This is going to be totally legit. And then I realized it was your handle, and I was like, oh, okay. Of course. It's genius.
I know you're a big fan of White Noise because of your posts and, like, I know that's how we eventually became friends on Twitter. We liked a lot of the same books, but you hadn't read either of these books before, correct?
No, I hadn't read Turncoat.
Did you? Or Did you enjoy the reading?
I loved Turncoat so much, and Limbo. But I did like Limbo, but Turncoat was special.
It ranks up with me as maybe my favorite book by him. I really love that book a lot, and especially the Trakhanov art. Is really, really good in that with Jason Wardy's colors. To me, it really is special. We're going to get into that second. I did want to, any news you guys want to bring up? I did want to bring up a movie trailer. I sent you all the link for it only because I'm partially obsessed in rooting for Simon Rex to win Best Actor this year at the Oscars because it's the most unlikely thing you'll ever hear ever is the guy that was Dirt Nasty. Might very well win Best Actor this year at the Oscars, which he has like a lot of people rooting for him from Con.
I mean, he's a cis white male, so I don't think he's going to have too much of a hard time winning an Oscar. But for his content, his body of work, yes, I would be surprised, and I'm rooting for him.
Yeah, I'm rooting for him. I just want to know what his Oscar speech is going to be like. I want to thank the porn producers that let me do my solo masturbation video 20 years ago to get me into Hollywood. I would like to thank Andy Milonakis and Mickey Avalon. Thank you, my homies. Like, I'm just really
really
excited.
Open the door for
He's
me.
He's probably good at grease and palms, which is really all it takes.
Oh, that's some nasty wordplay. Grease and palms.
And he just plays a complete scumfuck in that movie. And I really like Sean Baker, who did the Florida Project and Tangerine. Is like his fact of like casting all these non-actors around like usually one actor or just non-actors completely. So it's kind of cool that he just put Simon Rex in a town in Texas with a bunch of non-actors. And the craziest story I heard is when he hired him, he called him on October 23rd last year and said, "I want you to star in this movie, but I need an audition video for the studio. Can you send me a 5-minute audition video? And then can you immediately pack your bags and drive to Texas? Because if you fly here, they're going to quarantine you for 2 weeks and we need to start filming on the 26th. And then Simon Rex got in his car and drove to Texas and filmed this movie. Just LA to Texas is not a quick trip.
No.
No, that's a long
You get to
one.
See a lot of America in it, though. You know?
Yeah.
Mini America.
I've driven cross country. That's the part of America where I'm always like scared of gas stations, even though like I am also a cis white male. I don't know really what I'm worried about, but
Texas gas stations are an abomination.
Yeah, many gas stations across the I mean, you remember, Jack, when I was driving cross country with Panda and stuff, and then I come back and stop in town and then come back, and then we ended up destroying his car. Do you remember that when his car was destroyed?
I think that was after
his mom
I moved.
Drove. No, that was when you lived there. You just don't remember. But his mom came from Oklahoma and blamed me for destroying his car.
Oh, I think I do. Dude, Panda's a name.
Yeah, that was when I bought the van that Ronan cheapskated me on the van. All these like dirty hippie stories.
You didn't have a van before.
Ronan's a...
I don't know if I want to hear the story more about you destroying a car. Like the wild, bodacious trip that like put this car into ruin. Or the story of the mom coming from Oklahoma to be like, "You destroyed that car." Because that's a whole nother movie that sounds like pretty good.
The whole story is we drove back and forth from like West Coast, East Coast, going to festivals and me doing like work related things. And I was paying him. I paid him. I gave him place to stay. I fed him. He wasn't my servant. My friend Paulina used to call him my servant. He was not my servant. I had never had a servant. I don't want to sound like I owned anyone. Definitely against slave owners. But
definitely.
Yeah, I was going to say.
He was
a hard no.
Good to know anybody else's stance.
That should be all stances. But I just feel like it sounds weird when he was like my driver and I paid for like his entire living existence. I just feel like, does it sound weird? Like, it wasn't. He was my friend, and he helped me out a lot.
It sounds like the mafia more than I think it sounds like a servant master situation.
I don't want him to sound like that either, because then there'll be other questions brought up about my past. Don't sound like any kind of mafia or criminal enterprise.
He's your personal assistant.
He was my personal assistant. Yeah. So we were in his car, and one day we're driving down the hill from North San Juan after we got back from a country trip, and we'll get into the book. Sorry, we're tangenting off the top.
Oh, you're good.
So we're driving down the hill, and then like all of a sudden I'm in the passenger seat, and I start hearing, and then I look over to Panda, and I go, "That doesn't sound good." And he goes, "Oh, I should probably bring this up now. I haven't had an oil change in 2 years." And I went, "What?" And the entire engine exploded. But we literally drove like 6,000 miles in that car. I would have paid for his oil change at any time. Then his mom flies there and screams at me in the Ridge parking lot about, "You destroyed my son's car, make him go on all those trips." And I was like, "I would have paid for an oil change. I didn't know." And then she was like, "You're supposed to get an oil change every like 2,000 miles." And I was like, "She is right.
You tell him."
I mean, that's a useful fact if you think about 2,000 miles. I wouldn't think about that.
No.
You know, I don't drive that much, but I know I haven't had my oil changed in like 2 years. And it's something that I know I need to do because I get an email like every 2 months like, "Hey, you're overdue." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'll get there."
Well, you don't want to end up like Panda.
But,
so
my car hasn't started to make noise yet.
So. Yeah, that's good.
It won't until it's too late.
Right.
Yes, his noise was very sudden. His car was going smooth.
Will a light come on? That's what I'm waiting for. I'm like, when a light comes on, I'll get it.
That's what I was going to say. The light would come on unless the light is burned out.
Oh,
it's a whole nother problem. Yeah.
Now you're going to make me go check?
I think the logical transition here is to go back to gas stations in middle America and how they're terrifying but fascinating, like the town in this book called Limbo.
Because
it feels like one of those weird ports of call where all of these like the separate groups of life just pass through each other. Like, there's a whole culture, but you're just like an outsider in it, you know? I feel like that's Clay in the city.
Clay,
so he's a part of it. But
it reminds
he's not
me very
there.
Much of New Orleans and New Orleans gas stations, but like soaked in neon and kind of David Lynchy.
I was saying in the group chat that it kind of reminded me in a way of like Smoke at Aces, because he had all those different hitmen after him. But everybody mm-hmm. in the city was like just an insane character. Like the thumb wearing the Lucha Libre mask and like the marching band dudes with like their sewn up faces, like summoning snakes.
Mm-hmm. The teleshaman.
The teleshaman was fucking sick.
Yeah, which is one of my favorite characters.
Oh, I gotta say too that it was super surprising to me, because I sent you that like visualizer I put on a bunch of my tracks on Spotify. There was like the purple hypnosis spiral thing. And you were like, that'll fit perfectly. And I hadn't read Limbo yet. And so I read it right yeah, after. And was like, holy shit, I was having some premonition, dude.
I will say, don't tell my wife that I'm completely obsessed with Sandy. She's like my comic book
sure,
wife.
She's going to watch
something
this.
About Sandy. Yeah, she's going to listen to this and be like, that fictional character, I'm going to get her. Something about her and just dancing to Kool and the Gang to kind of appease her voodoo gods, and just the fact of making mixtapes for gods, I find really fascinating.
She had a really cool intro. I really liked how they introduced her.
That's what caught me right there. I was like hypnotized. Like, oh yeah.
I kind of like that our
dance to Legba.
Femme Fatale was a goddess of death in disguise, wearing a skin suit.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. Bridget was awesome.
That is a later reveal, but that is she was like the classic femme fatale. Like both books, definitely. It's funny that Alex brought up the covers look the same, which I didn't even notice when I posted that picture, that they're literally like exactly the same. I feel like Dan really uses this in both books, but this one especially as like a deconstruction of the private eye, like with Bridget being, you know, a goddess of death, and her coming in with this case, and she's definitely the femme fatale you can't trust. And he really creates like a Lynchian neon soaked hard boiled noir, but it's set like with the aesthetic of voodoo and 80s videotapes, as Chaz said yesterday or the last time we recorded. And it definitely seems like Caspar and Dan, for fans of Homesick Pilots, have kind of created a niche with videotapes, because that's also a huge part in Homesick Pilots. There's a videotape ghost who's, you know, a really great character. But this book I really enjoy. It's kind of one I always like to reread. It just is like, it's like a comfort food for me. I just like seeing Clay's journey, and it sucks that it wasn't read much, because I feel like the ending definitely leaves for maybe there's going to be more. But what are you guys' thoughts? Chaz, I haven't heard you talk yet, and I know Ellis, you said you like it, and Jack, I want to hear your thoughts too, but you look like you're worrying you're going to fade out of the ether again in any second. So.
You'll oh, no.
fade
well,
into
I
the Breenaverse
tell
behind
you. A quick little shot that's I just wanted to bring up real briefly that it reminded me a lot of Snow Crash, which is like my favorite book ever, in the way that they took like the videotapes and the mixtapes and everything and brought the like technological stuff in with the aspects of religion, except they did it with voodoo, which is like super sick. Anyway, that's what I wanted to add in. I want to hear
the blend of
L too.
I was gonna say take it away, L. I'll bat last. Oh, yeah, now get up in now. Here.
No, I what if I didn't? Right?
You're all like, oh.
Just fake it. Just bring
colors
it something
cool.
else up.
The colors
be like,
be
like Chaz
Assassin's
last
Creed
week for
episodes.
Assassin's Creed. Yeah. Bring up.
Just describe what games you want to see fictionally to buy time.
I don't even actually like Assassin's Creed.
Well, you're in good company. Don't worry.
I'm medium on it.
No. I heard one of you guys say it. So yeah. So when you guys are talking about it,
I want to be.
Like I did. I do think it is unfortunate that this was overlooked, because especially having read Homesick Pilots and seeing like how much they took from that, from Limbo for Homesick. I think they're both really good, but it kind of reminded me of, you know, like the Valiant Shadow Man.
Yeah,
you know,
punk Mambo
stuff like
almost.
That. Yeah. Punk Mambo, and which is one of my favorites. But I think the art for this, I do like the art in it, but I think it's not everybody's cup of tea. And so I think that might have been one of the factors in it. Because it is kind of, I don't know, like, it, or maybe it was just because I had just read Turncoat right before.
Oh, I could see that.
So it seemed like almost too simple. Yeah. Like
I did the opposite, or Limbo than Turncoat. Going from Trakhanov's art to this, like, earlier Wingheart, yeah, I could understand that completely.
Yeah. And, but I did, I did like the story. I loved Sandy. She was, like, a vibe the entire book. And then I liked the idea of, like, testing man. Like, this is all, like, well, I guess that's a spoiler, but, you know, like, this is all a game for, you know, the gods, like. And I really liked that aspect of it, too.
Me as well. Like, yeah. The fact that it's all a bet, just seeing if a bad person can do good in the afterlife, basically, or in limbo because he's not yet dead.
And even then, it's like, you guys are still cheating on both sides, so it's like, let them, you're not even letting them play.
Right. Yeah, just decide for yourselves and tell man, instead of like, oh yeah, I can't cheat a lot, they'll know, and then it won't be fun, I'll get in trouble, or whatever, and it's like, but you're cheating, you're still doing it.
And it speaks on human nature, I think, too, because, you know, regardless of the cheating, maybe that speaks on... Clay, I don't think, is his real name. I mean, if you see his body, he looks very different when he's in the emergency room. He's got, like, brown hair. Or in the Dadan City, he has, like, whitish hair and he's blue. And, you know, maybe he's just prone to violence, as they've hinted he was not a good person. He keeps screaming, you know, he's choking someone to death, obviously, but maybe before he got in the state that he's currently in. And maybe just he's prone to death. Because, I mean, at the point where he actually kills the thumb, which is funny because it's actually his thumb, when he kills the thumb, he knows now what's going on. He's already seen his videotape from Dagon. He knows the game, and he still makes that choice.
He's blue with white hair, just like my Zoom background. Neil Breen inverted. But also, like, Mitsuki? Am I pronouncing it? Yeah, Mitsuki. My favorite Boruto character.
Yeah.
But the thumb, I like how the thumb was like a double entendre, because at first you think it's like, oh, because they have him under, he has them under his thumb, you know? And it is. That is part of why he's the thumb. But it's also literally his thumb later on, like the metaphor for his thumb that's moving because he's in this brain dead coma, but what haunts him from his past is causing his thumb to twitch as he's having these nightmares.
Yeah, and to help our listeners, because we probably still know that we're talking about insanity right now and not too much, you know, coherence. The whole story is set up like a PI story with this Bridget gets Clay to basically take down the thumb, and you find out later on that this entire city is actually in the consciousness of Clay's actual body, and he's in limbo. He's basically at a hospital in the process between life and death, and two gods, Baron Saturday and Bridget, who's... Was she given a name besides Bridget? Am I forgetting? I think she was just called Bridget, right? Or does anyone else remember if she had an actual name? I could look in the book right now, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, let me scroll through.
She did have an actual name, but I can't remember what it was.
He just calls her wife and Bridget, I'm pretty sure. But anyway, they're playing a game of this guy's soul and whether, you know, he was a terrible man in life, and they're seeing if in his limbo state in Dadan City he can do some good, actually. Whereas Bridget's playing the game, hoping that he would go for good, and then Baron Saturday is saying he can't change, which is the rules of the game. They both cheat, as we've said earlier, and it's kind of this just, you know, it feels like he was heavily inspired by Nicholas Winding Refn. There's a lot of scenes in this book that remind me directly of Drive, especially in the last issue when it's just Clay's back and he's walking through the club with the baseball bat and beating the shit out of people. That reminds me so much of Ryan Gosling with the hammer walking through the strip club in Drive.
The colors are very like Neon Demon-esque too, which was a crazy fucking movie. If anyone hasn't seen it, they should.
Neon Demon is crazy. You know, it's even
crazy. Understand it.
You know what's crazy again? Oh, you should also try to watch Too Old to Die Young.
I have it on my watch list.
That one's too much.
I'm going to try it again.
They should not have given him a whole show. Even him and Ed Brubaker, like, it's awesome.
With two hour and 40-minute long episodes?
It's like I can't if they have watch to be... 15 fucking Nicholas Wending Refn, is that it? Fucking movies in a row. It's hard to pronounce, man.
Yeah.
But I can't watch like 10 of those movies in a row. It's too much. Like, I can watch one. And there's really
no
good.
One... Like, no one likable in that show. Like, the most likable characters are John Hawks, that's like a dying cop.
Yeah.
And then Jenna Malone, who's like a weird psychic, but she's also like a mob boss killer. But I mean, our main characters are...
What about the Baldwin?
A Mexican drug lord and a cop that's dating a teenager are our main characters.
And his dad
trying to also have sex. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen it, Al. We've talked about it before. But
I've never even heard of it. It's an Amazon show. I just pulled it up and I put it on my watch list.
You would think like
the most of Only God Forgives, which is like might be my favorite by him, but it's like really fucked up and dark.
Yeah, it's bad. It's one of those movies where there's no hero at all.
No,
there's no one.
Everyone's just like the closest you can imagine.
Yeah, like you can't even root for Ryan Gosling's character. Because there's no redemption for him.
It's kind of like Breaking Bad in that way. I was just watching that with Alex.
The
it's like,
crime he's avenging.
There's no Jesse, though.
Raping, that's true. Murdering. He was only supposed to be around for the first season.
Really? Yeah, and he's the most redeemable character. Yeah, he was supposed to die originally, much like Jack on Lost.
I just sent y'all in the Zoom chat here. I sent y'all a picture.
It's making me down.
How about the William Baldwin insanity, though, Al? As William Baldwin plays a teenager's dad that Miles Teller is dating, and you would think they're going to have this really confrontational meeting when they meet, and then William Baldwin's just making passes at Miles Teller the entire time, and the first time they meet, the girl goes out of the bedroom, and he jumps up like a tiger on her bed and starts doing tiger growls while swiping towards Miles Teller's
with the fucking stuffed animals. He's like rubbing with the stuffed animals on him and on himself. It's the most awkward fucked shit I've ever seen. Not really, but it was close.
I watched the last two episodes eventually, and it's just full of murder and death, but the sixth episode was really hard for me, is the episode where he's trying to take down the porn maker brothers, which will... It's just the gnarliest Nicholas Winding Refn stuff.
I need to pick it back up.
Oh, he was a character model for Hartman in Death Stranding. Yeah.
Who was? William Baldwin?
No. Nicholas Winding Refn.
Oh, wow. That's cool. I've never played that game. I've heard good things about it.
So you want to know what Limbo reminds me of?
Yeah.
Strangely. I shouldn't say strangely, because it's Waters. This feels like a proto Coffin Bound. This feels like Coffin Bound in a brighter, less deserty. This feels like, you know, in a Steven Soderbergh movie, there's two colors. There's like Mexico desert that's like oversaturated and super bleached and like hard to look at. That was Coffin Bound. And then there's like cold blue Detroit that's in like all of his movies where it's like steely and cold and crazy looking. Like, there's always that really rich contrast between two places in his films. This is like the cold, steely city, and then Coffin Bound was like the real overdone, bleached out, super saturated southwest town. It's wild, because you have things like the thumb describing himself as the heel. Like you said, it's very Lynchian. It has like all those like Twin Peaks villain vibes of like, I am the representation of the evil in this town. And that evil is that you use your thumb probably to pull the hammer of a gun back and kill someone. Maybe you shot yourself. Because he damns himself at the end by killing the thumb. So like,
that's true.
Is that thing keeping him alive? That random brain spasm? So, but then you got scenes like the one I sent y'all where they pull the skin mask down, and it's probably just for us reader, but like, it's so Coffin Bound feeling of the skin coming off, like them degloving themselves and their body, like this stripping down of human nature. And then like that similar juxtaposition between like reality and fantasy, right? Like in this town where like, and especially PI things and those hard-boiled books, like, there's always that real colorful metaphor language for how they're really looking at the world. Like, this ain't that. This isn't one of those stories or whatever. But this embodies all of those stories, kind of. Like, it's got those weird mysteries.
Yeah, and then the art change in Necropolis.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And she's upside down. And then
the breakdowns also. Like, the breakdowns when he's first just sucked in with the teleshaman and, you know, kind of the way the world's always changing, and he runs through, like, several different movie scenes, Max Headroom. He runs through Super Mario. He's also kind of in the William Gibson X, like, cyberscape, and then into, like, a straight-up Street Fighter. He's just running through, like, videotapes, which, like, so many different, like, worldviews. And kind of with, yeah, I could... This, it seems like a prototype to, like, Coffin Mount and Homesick Pilots, like Al brought up. It seems like a lot of his ideas... he originally had with this, he kind of got to really, you know, tell
further explore.
Yeah. Once he had was bigger, you know what I mean? It seems like once his name, because now the books sell, like Coffin Mount was popular and, you know, Homesick Pilots is popular, like more popular than Limbo was. But I mean, Limbo's from 2015, which is crazy. That's around the same time as the Assassin's Creed books. So, I mean, this is like a really big, to me, a big swing. As we talk about Steve Orlando's always swinging. Like, this is a big swing for your first book to get published by Image.
I'm going to go ahead and say that I liked this, like, 50 times more than Assassin's Creed 2, and they came out at, like, the same time.
Oh. You're saying this assassinated Assassin's Creed in your mind?
And I say that because Assassin's Creed was fun, but this was, like, really fucking good. So,
well, it feels
I
like a passion
realized,
project, too,
oh,
which
totally.
Is the difference.
You can tell he put a ton of love into it. What I'm just realizing now is that by... when Saturday was in the girl's body, and she made the decision to keep him as Sisyphus inside of his own brain dead world, pushing that boulder, it was the girl's decision, but the girl was like, an embodiment of his wife. And so, in a way, she totally won the bet, but he didn't even realize it. And that's when she talks about the manipulation, how it's easy to manipulate him by because he thinks he's above manipulation and doesn't realize it. So I just realized, like, whoa, dude, she totally won. That was pretty
good.
Sick.
Always wins in the end.
There's some really crazy layers, like they talk about in the book.
That was just going to bring about the layers of how it kind of deals with the universe and it and I and how she describes, you know, basically TV screens in the way of how we're constantly spiraling and how we have, you know, the universe in micro and in macro. And just, you know, each screen is like a different level of the consciousness, which is kind of how it breaks down into how we get to the Dawn City. And, you know, as he said, the id, the I, the human mind, and kind of how this... using videotapes and using this like town to kind of describe and all the crazy different symbols and just, you know, describe this kind of battle between the I and the id it's just really interesting. And especially because, you know, I love the 80s aesthetic too, and to see it used in such a different way. Like, most people will just play, you know, vaporwave music in a movie and they'll just have a lot of cool shots. Like in a Nicholas Winding Refn movie, it'll be vaporwave music and, like, a lot of neon. And this is soaked in neon, but they're really going deeper with kind of the existential battle with, you know, a man's soul. And that just, I find interesting.
Real
government bureaucracy sucks.
Beatrice, super red the whole time through. Bridget? It's so, like, oh, yeah, sorry, yeah, Bridget. Yeah. Bridget, super red the whole time through. Like... The way that she stands in contrast to Clay, like, every time they interact is so good. And at times, they, like, really play up the blue in him and the red in her. Like that diner scene where he's got the little action figure. Maddo.
Give him a solo.
Yeah, I really want more of him, to be honest. I'd love to read the Maddo adventures.
I love that
he was a necklace at the end was so great. So happy to be there.
Right. I love when Maddo saves Sandy and you think it's like some other huge god or something. And he's like, I'm her protector. And then he comes back and you're like, oh, it was Maddo.
Why couldn't I see you? Well, I didn't put that spell on myself, so you can't blame me for that. But it works real good, so that's good, right? It's like
what? I really like the lettering in this book too. especially like it was easy to differentiate kind of what was at stake based on the fonts. And then, like, the calls and stuff, the font they used for that, I really like that. Even on the front of the book, I love that font they used for Limbo.
Oh, yeah, the actual, like, Limbo title is great. Freaking Jim Campbell crushing it in this. He always crushes it. But, yeah, the lettering in this is good. And it's, besides, in this, the whole design, art, and colors are all Caspar, which is crazy. I mean, you see that sometimes now, but usually it's a team, whereas this is literally just three people. When you see usually three names in the book, they're cutting, like, two people out, but this is really just three people. Yeah, the lettering I love, the colors I absolutely love. Wingard's art, I know I'm a big fan of his art, but I could definitely see what you meant about it. It was kind of jarring to go from Turncoat to this, because I know that Chaz does not love him as much as
I like his covers.
Okay. He's solid. This feels like it's got like parts of Oming with a little bit of like McKelvey in the mix. You know Definitely. What I mean? Like a little bit of a blend of those two. I think he's more polished now. Like this to me, if you had told me it didn't get picked up by Image, but Scout wanted to publish it like now, I'd believe it. This feels like it could have been a Scout title. Like it's got enough their polish where it's like, looks, oh yeah. No, yeah. On the grit level.
I was surprised it was Image.
But Especially it's definitely like a little bit, you could tell it's there. But, like, it needs something every now and again. I don't know.
He flexes hard in some scenes. Like, especially, like, the layout where Dagon's showing him his life on the videotape. It's, like, the different video screens.
The filter and stuff. Yeah. Like, I love... And then, like I said, the Sandy going through Necropolis is probably, like, some of my favorite art in the whole trade.
Yeah.
So I think, but then some pages, like the beginning, I was like, oh, okay. Coming from Turncoat, that is, like, I was like, okay, I guess. I could get into it.
I know
it.
Alex doesn't do it as much, but I know that Dan and Rom like to try to sneak white noise into all their books because that's their production label, and it's so apparent in this because the white noise of the TV is static, and then him just hearing it, I love how they put that in it as an aesthetic as well, and Rom did that to us on our own episode when he talked about the author of White Noise for like an hour, and then we didn't even realize that's who he was talking about and how they got their name. So it's cool when they do little tricks like that. But this, like, like the static and the white noise of the TV screens in this, you know, great aesthetic. That marching band that, you know, makes people go crazy and snakes out of their mouths. Another,
like, so dude that are hired.
Yeah. The mannequins.
The mannequins are off top.
There's like all
mannequins.
The snakes start filling up the mannequins, and they're like running around these mannequins full of snakes for our listeners. It was awesome.
Just the fact that they took refuge, they went to a safe house, they opened it up, it was filled with mannequins, and they're like, "Well,
let's hang out here.
or whatever." And in my mind, it's like, "No, you could go on the beach. That's better than being surrounded by these death machines and wait."
They're creepy, but I mean, who would expect mannequins to like come to life full of snakes and start
in a town
to
where
you?
Like snakes just came out of a lady's mouth?
That's true.
Me,
that's true,
big time, 100%. I just watched snakes come out of somebody. I'm not gonna stand next to an inanimate person, essentially.
Like mannequins are for Elle, snakes are for me. I don't fuck with snakes. Like where I grew up in Northern California, snakes would just always get out and then be like on your porch, and then you'd be risk being bit.
There was just a rattlesnake over on my and porch, I just like a month ago, like a huge black rattlesnake. It was
exactly
terrifying.
That's what I'm talking about. But baby rattlesnakes like will be on your porch and they'll kill you if they bite you. Just
it's like if I walked outside my door.
Too many. Yeah. And just going to get your dad to kill it with a shovel and chop its head off was just too much of a current normal thing I did when I was a child. So I'm just terrified. And when I go hiking, you just see snakes out, you know, in the summer. You know what I'm talking about, Jack.
Wait,
and they're just
weren't you in
literally
Santa Rosa?
Out on the trail. No. I'm talking about in the Bay Area, like Santa Clara area. But also just
Santa Clara. Okay, I thought you were in Santa Rosa for some reason.
Santa Clara, San Jose area and stuff like that. And like Saratoga. Mostly the Santa Cruz Mountains, which is right there too. So like Santa Cruz hiking and stuff like that.
Woodsy enough that there's snakes.
Yeah, I mean, snakes are all over Santa Cruz in the summer when you go on the hiking trails. It's literally terrible. I mean, they're not all rattlesnakes, but I don't like big green snakes either when I'm just walking calmly on the trail. I'd be like, this is going to be a great day.
There's a lot
and then
of
there's
really
three
cute
snakes just
snakes
chilling
there.
Yeah, there's a little red ones that aren't supposed to be venomous.
That's something I like about, like, I'm not a big the woods, but I like that there's tons of adorable little frogs and lizards and snakes.
Yeah, I'm from Orange County, so the most nature I dealt with was, like, tadpoles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, not much nature. What city are you from?
I last lived in Buena Park, and then before that, Fullerton, and before that... There was a point where I lived in Buena Park when I was like a kid. Buena Park, nice.
I think the longest I lived was in the city of Orange.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
City of Orange?
Orange is fun.
Tustin and Glassell and Lincoln, like over there.
Yeah, awesome. Michael lived
another
in Fullerton,
another one of my best friends
too,
from
Huntington
Beach.
Or Anaheim?
I never lived in Fullerton. I've never lived in Anaheim. I have friends from there. When I lived in L.A., I lived in, like, Los Angeles.
Oh, I thought I remember you telling me that you, like, lived right near
I have friends from Huntington Beach. Oh,
okay.
No, I was living in Pasadena when I told you I was close to you and tried to have you come hang out with me. Yeah, Limbo is a great book. If you love Dan Waters and you're a fan of Coffin Bound and a fan of any of the work he's done, I really do think you're going to love this book. It's crazy. It's, you know, it's one of his first published works. And I really hope more people discover it, because now that Homesick Pilots has taken off, maybe one day we'll return to this world, or maybe they'll just use the aesthetic. Because I was going to say before we stop that it's really interesting how Papa Legba is definitely, like, also a prototype for the tape ghost that's in Homesick Pilots. Like, literally, they look exactly the same. So it's cool that they get to flesh those ideas out even more in Homesick Pilots, which is a book I really enjoy. And I hope it keeps going. I don't know if it's going to have just 10 issues or they're going to go farther, but definitely check out Limbo. Now we will talk about Turncoat, which is by Alex Pachnidel, drawn by Artyom Trakhanov, I'm probably butchering that word, colored by Jason Wordy, and it is lettered by Colin Bell. Elle, you love this book a lot, and you just read it. It's about a girl named Marta Gonzalez in this world that's really wonderfully created, where an alien race called the Management controlled the Earth for 300 years, and then they recently left the Earth because human forces took over and were able to defeat them, because Marta basically linked information about their main ship, the Gallant, which we'll find out why later through the book. But I absolutely love this book. It's one of my favorite Pachnidel books. I love also that it's like the common detective story, but in a new, different kind of world. I think it has a lot of political themes underneath the water and surface in the book, even though Alex would probably say that we're looking too much into the book.
Like underneath he said last the Dan time Waters.
On the show. Underneath the Dan Waters. But, what were your thoughts on this book? I'm glad to hear you loved it so much.
Oh, so, yeah, I did really like Turncoat. What I like the, first of all, the art is amazing. It's like, kind of like a Toxic Avenger, like Alex Zurit, if that's how you say their names.
Alexis Zurit? Yeah, or Zurit, yeah.
It kind of had those kind of vibes. I liked how her name was different. Like, in every situation, in every encounter, like, her badge would say Gonzalez with a S, and then it would say Gonzalez with a C, and then it would be, like, a completely different last name, like, depending on who she was talking to throughout the book. I thought that was, like, a nice little touch.
Definitely.
And, I love the little, like, circular insects on some of the panels that, like, zoomed in on certain things, yeah. Like, oh, like, pay attention to this. I really liked that. And just even, like, when they introduced, like, the sister in the park, and they were like, oh, no, she's a human. She was just born into an exoskeleton. I was like, oh, that has to suck. Like, that was, like, really, like, visually to see that was really cool. And then the story, like, it's called Turncoat, and so you get the first Turncoat, you're like, oh, okay. But no, like, every issue, it, like, oh, no, this is a Turncoat, too. This is also a Turncoat. And I was like, oh, my gosh.
Betrayal
so
around every turn.
So who's the real Turncoat?
Right?
Yeah.
All of
my
them.
My feelings were hurt by the
everyone. The true nature of humanity.
Truly spoil it, but the last page is definitely like a punch in the gut, kind of explain the whole journey she's been going on. The bugs are awesome. I love thing I like, art's amazing. Trakhanov's art is literally fantastic. I do also love all the little bugs. I gotta say, I love the bugs at the end that mate for life, and when they get separated, one lets out a scream and then the other one glows, and they use that for a tracking device, which I thought was freaking brilliant. And I love that her relationship with William Mann, who is kind of the leader of the human resistance, that's also another turncoat, and like he's a character that you keep on going back and forth on, at least for me. I'm like, oh, this guy's actually good.
Absolutely.
He has her best interests at heart. And then like a few pages later,
his last name is Mann.
Fuck this guy. Matt, one thing I do love is like not showing the management I find so powerful. And when you finally do see what they look like, which is the very end of the book, they're nothing what I thought they were going to look like. Like I thought they were going to look way more bug-like and alien-like, but they're kind of like, they're kind of even hard to describe. They're kind of humanoid themselves, but the fact that they're in the shadows the entire book, but they're such a presence, you know, that even though they've now left the earth, they still kind of like linger there. And yeah, as El said, everyone's a turncoat. Like
Alex, say that out there exists like full visual representations of the management that were like circulating around the releases in like limited numbers.
Yeah,
because you don't really fully
see
them.
They had like
a
special print where they had designed like the actual look of management.
It's kind of cool now. Knowing it's that mystery box thing.
Yeah,
those aren't management at the very end. The three guys that come in and tell her, you know, without revealing too much what's going on, give her the bad news.
Hold on, let me get to the last page.
So like the last,
here.
I don't know if I'll remember, I have the book right here. So like, look, but like the last. Like four pages of the book, when you find out why she is so hellbent on, you know, finding these hybrids and why she's trying to get redemption through the hybrids, the reason why she decided to turn on them and rat them out, those three guys come in. One has like bug red eyes, and the other two guys got kind of weird ass shit growing off their neck. I thought those were management. Are they just other sorts of hybrids? I don't know for sure. So this is my open
thoughts. No, they're just other sorts of hybrids.
Yeah.
I remember when he showed us he like held up the thing, and it did not look like a person.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
Yeah, it was. They were kind of like almost like Eldritch like vibe, alien things.
Yeah, there's shit still growing everywhere in New York too. There's weird pterodactyl creatures flying around everywhere, the whole world is so well built. Like the characters, even the background, like Quentin, the drug dealer who has like one scene really, and All these characters so well built, and his relationship with is it Jeremy, the other character's name, his boyfriend, that they get kind of involved early. Because so to get into the plot a little bit, Marta, like I said in the beginning, has turned on the management, and now humans have taken back the city, and she made a deal with William Mann, who was the leader of the resistance, and now he's the mayor of New York City. And basically all management's gone, and she is now a private detective, and a woman comes to her looking for her son. And she suspects her son may be a hybrid, because when management were still in control, they were making hybrid babies with humans. But William Mann has said that all of the hybrids were killed, that they were all gathered up and shot in Central Park on Cherry Hill. But that turns out to be a lie, that they actually killed a bunch of humans that were basically loyal
dissonance.
To the management. Dissonance, yeah, loyal to the management. And, you know, she's just hell-bent on finding these hybrids and bringing them to safety. And we don't know why eventually, though. We do know there are weird drug addictions in this world. There's the squirmers, which look like...
I love the squirmers. I keep wanting to mention that those are my favorite part. They're so cute.
How do you think they do them? I think they show them in one scene. I know how they do that.
I think they like stick them in their ear. That's how I imagine it. They like suck on their brain.
What kind of high is worth you sticking something that's like an insect in your ear canal?
I just suck on your brain.
I mean, I assume it's good.
I don't know. It must be a good one, man. It's like those DMT frogs.
Oh, God.
I'm going to throw up, but it's going to be worth it.
Yeah, it's like ayahuasca, right? Going to throw up, but it's totally going to be worth
it. If you don't eat sugar and don't eat meat for 2 weeks before your ayahuasca trip, you won't throw up. I didn't throw up my ayahuasca trip. I mean, other crazy shit happened. I will talk later when we bring up Midnight Mass that I'm pretty sure I said the exact speech of Katie Siegel at the end of Midnight Mass when I was on ayahuasca and acid. I'm like, yep, I've said that. I was pretty sure getting ahead of time that I'm pretty sure Mike Flanagan has done ayahuasca with his wife. And he always puts, real jumping ahead, he always puts strangely Northern California locations in his shows. And I'm always like, I see you, Mike Flanagan. I know you're doing ayahuasca up in Hudson, Northern California. I see you.
I know you've been to some somewhat reputable sweat lodge.
Yes, when will we bring up? We have not brought her up long enough.
We can make that one in passing. We'll circle back to it for Midnight
Mass. Kind of tangent real quick. I've thought about writing a script about undercover feds going undercover at Starlight Compost compound, and like the really liberal one turning kind of hard edge, and then the conservative one kind of getting obsessed with the cult and just running around naked in sweat lodges and just completely,
it's,
you know.
It's like The Odd Couple, but for narcs.
Yeah, but like narcs.
Yeah, I love
it. I'm thinking like Tom Holland, Ryan Reynolds, and Ryan Reynolds is like the liberal one in the beginning, and Tom Collins, like a Texas-born, hard-edged, like, Christian boy. And
then he's now wise to the ways of the world.
Now he's having orgies, and he's running around naked, covered in sweat, and being like, well, Starlight, show me the way!
They couldn't like, go full orgy, though. You can't get that in an R-rated movie. He's just got to imply, like, there's so many people that want to have sex with me. And then Ryan Reynolds will be like,
no, he just walks in.
Because they want you to die for them or something.
He walks into like Starlight Sweat Lodge and comes out and is like, ooh, that was a doozy of an orgy. That's all we need.
Exactly.
I think just for our 100th episode, we got to get Starlight on this show. I think it'll be.
She might not be like, well, she has a radio show, but I was going to say she might not be like willing to be interfaced with technology enough to be on a podcast.
When they do Symbiosis again, we can go to Kid Biosis and interview her on the spot. I'll bring Willow up and be like, here's my baby, good to see you. Here's a microphone, here's the laptop, we're recording now.
She's gonna hit your baby with that unholy like baptism. That's some sort of strange, like, this is our ritual baptism.
I adorned it in the skin of the raccoon that I found this morning. I've told her stories about how she had everyone running around naked in her property, including the kids, and my wife was like, oh no, that lady can't come anywhere near our daughter.
That's a smart move. I understand. Get them hooks in there early.
That's like, I just want to imagine like a suit and tie kind of like businessman going and seeing their reaction to a day at Starlight Compost compound.
Well, my friend Matt Brown, when he was visiting in town, we went to that like hangout barbecue and slap pong day that Kev hosted
at the
park. And there was like 50 people there and kids and families, and Matt's just hanging out there drinking a beer, and Starlight walks up fully clothed and drops all of her clothes and gets completely naked. He did a full mouth gape and went, what the fuck is that lady doing? And I was like, oh, that's just Starlight. And he's like, Michael, gnarly. There's kids around. And I was like, yeah, we can't stop her. So I don't know what you're going to do.
This is kind of her property.
Dude, Michael, did you go to me and Kev's slap and trap?
I don't think so. The last time we were hanging out, slap pong and trap music party. Back to Turncoat, though. I'm surprised there's not an alien pandemic in this.
There's like a seamless fusion of weird aliens technology to like be your headphone or just be on your body at all points. Everybody in this book, vaccines. I think, maybe
very
other than Marta.
District 9, yeah.
Yeah, like is all like infused almost or has some sort of like living part of this tech on them.
I think that's what I liked about it too. Like without seeing management, everybody just looks human. Mm-hmm. So it kind of made it even more like, okay, who's right and who's wrong? Because who is to say that management came to do something nefarious? Because everybody looks the same.
Yeah.
And does the tech enhance life or is it making it worse? Because it kind of seems like it could be either way, even on that front. So I think it was really interesting. And even with that, one of my favorite quotes from it, when she goes, she's like, sometimes you only have to dip your toe in the water to be too deep. And I was like, yeah. You
Words to live by.
Yeah.
And then but one of the first panels, like, I was like, mouth open when she gets at the very beginning of the book and she gets stabbed by William.
She's stabbed in the side.
Stabbed.
Yeah.
And she's like, William, man. And then she's like, Bill. I was like, Bill? You know him?
Yeah.
Not you with a pet name.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Kind of telling so much just with that little bit of storytelling.
Like in the first couple pages, I was like, oh, this is about to be good.
Yeah. The world is so built, like, and these characters so built. For four issues, it seems so much longer than four issues. It's definitely a book that, like, when I get in it farther, I feel more bummed because I'm like, oh, I want more. It leaves such an impression for something that's only 4 issues long. I feel bad because I have a line I really loved in it, and I was going to write it down when I was doing my reread last night, and I made the poor decision of not doing that. And so, like, right before recording, I've been, like, paneling through it, being like, I think it was near the end.
It's because there's so many good ones. How do you choose there's just so many one? Good ones.
These white noise boys.
Now, this had a lot of vibes like Arcadia. Like, I just didn't want it to be over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These white noise boys know how to write dialogue.
I love that we... Noise boys do know how to write dialogue and create characters. Like, the first time you meet Matt Dyson, he seems like he's going to be, you know, the one guy who helps her when she's in a bar full of cops that want to, like, completely destroy her because she, you know, she turncoated on everyone and ratted them out. But then, like, very quickly we find out he's the antagonist, which is, I think, a hallmark of a lot of great PI stories where you actually find out the bad guy before the actual hero does. And you kind of just follow and learn because, like, he goes from, like, kind of, like, her helpful, funny ex-partner to, like, brutal psychopath very quickly. But then you kind of see in flashbacks he was always that awful. I mean, there's that flashback where they're in Harlem where he threatens to kill Marta when they're having a normal conversation.
And then once you get to the ending and you realize, like, he must have known that about her past and this is what he's doing now with the... Yeah. I was like, wow. Awful.
He's not a good partner or a good person in his transition in that. And I feel so bad for Quentin. I feel so glad. We don't even see Quentin get it, but he obviously was disposed of. And poor Jeremy looking for Quentin, even though...
And all the panels where they, like, zoom in on Marta, it's so expressive. The art is so abstract, but the expression that they were able to give her in those specific panels are so good.
Definitely. One I love is when she comes in to see the mother again. I think Grace Weaver. Mm-hmm. And Matt's there having tea with her, saying he's helping her on the investigation, but her expression is she totally knows he's the one that did this then. Like, she knows he's not there to help her at all, that he's there just to find out what she knows. Yeah, it's Grace Weaver. Like, that expression on Marta's face is totally the eye widening, like, holy fuck, Matt's the one doing this. Like, immediately knowing that it's him. The end is so emotional. Like, it's one of those great stories, like, without spoiling too much, it reminded me a lot reading recently of Party and Pray because of how that's so much of a survival tale. And this felt very much in a survival tale with me when she's, you know, doing the right thing and helping those hybrids. It was very much, I got to get out of here and survive. And just kind of seeing our main character get put through a harrowing experience. Because regardless of what she's done in her past, Marta's definitely compassionate. And you feel a lot of compassion towards her. But she goes through so much shit in this. And, like, the only people who are on her side, which is sad, are complete scum fucks who will kill her in a minute. From Matt to Bill, who is the only person that's, like, really holding her up. And then just the fact she knows about his drug source, he wants her dead. Even though he helped go find her, but he wasn't going to find her. He was going to find the hybrids. Like, you keep thinking he actually cares about her, and then it completely, you get shown.
Especially with the end, because it's like he had to be the one who gave that order. And so it's like, but she's still so loyal to him. And she has to know that at that point in the beginning, that or 5 years prior, that he was the one who did that. And she stayed loyal to him.
Yeah, loyal to him the entire time. I mean, it's funny that she was riding out to the humans and he was riding out to the management. Is this complete parallels? Maybe that's why they were so connected, too, is they both know they were similar in that way. And they're not even talking about the crazy drug that everyone's addicted to and all these hybrids are at risk for, which is a truth serum. I guess you could say it's kind of like a stimulating acid, because acid used to be used as a true serum. We'd love to bring up LSD as much as possible.
Of course. So,
but it was like an alien LSD, which it's comes out of a barb from their arm. And comic books and acid. Get your comic books and acid. I was going to say last time, the red and blue characters in Limbo, you know what they reminded me of? The Grateful Dead.
I thought you were going to say The Matrix. The red pill.
The Matrix also. The blue pill. Wait, are we going to get into... Real quick nonsense, guys. We're almost in. This is going to one more tangent. Do you guys think the original Matrix was created because of William Gibson novels and people were starting to figure out we were in a simulation? So the simulation made a movie about us being in a simulation so we would stop thinking we're in a simulation. And now 20 years have passed and people like my boss and other people in the world have said they're pretty convinced we're in a simulation. So people start realizing we're in a simulation again. So they're like, we got to release another movie about us being in a simulation so people don't think they're in a simulation. It's going to be a meta movie where the Matrix is actually a movie in it. And that's just another simulation. So then they won't realize that they're in a simulation.
Yeah, I've had some wine. That sounds pretty spot on.
I could be a little bit more inebriated before I'm like onto that on that level. I'm like close, I'm following, but I'm the not logic. Quite.
I'm following.
Yeah. Like I'm not about to fall off the flat earth, but I'm there. Like I think I'm picking up what you're putting down, Michael.
I'm opening a Google tab on that.
Yeah, I don't. That would preclude the idea that the algorithm is smart enough to learn for this simulation. Like, if the idea is that we're in a simulation and our minds are realizing it, so to justify to cope with it, it came up with basically Kung Fu, the allegory of the cave by Plato, that to prepare us for like finding out about it, but then we were all just like super content, like, oh no, it's just some sci-fi Kung Fu karate bullshit, like, tight, that was cool. Did you see the glass made like a wave and then it fucking exploded all over Sick. Neo and Trinity? It was awesome, right? And then like 2 and 3 are like, you either love them, like you fucking ride or die for them, or you're like, yeah, I'll watch like 8 of the fights from them, but I don't really want to watch the whole thing. I'll watch like him fight a bunch of dudes on the freeway and then like those like weird twins and like all them guys in the French chateau or whatever. Like, I just want to watch the highlights of 2 and 3, right? Because if that's if the idea is like, oh, I gave you 3 movies to process this and y'all didn't get it, I'm gonna remake it and make the movie inside the make the old movie be a movie inside the new movie.
It would sound crazy if it wasn't true.
That would mean that the machine should have been smart enough from the jump to like introduce it.
And we all know Grant Morrison's running the machine.
It erases.
Yes.
Yep. It erases the whole idea of Zion being a matrix inside of the bigger matrix. That's just where the people who are like, I can't take this fake 1999 bullshit, and they're like, oh, you want to wake up to the real world? And they're like, hell yeah. And they're like, it fucking sucks. But your mind is like, yeah, it does. That means it's real because I'm suffering. Right? That's just Zion. Because otherwise, why would they need to resurrect? Why would they unplug 18 people or whatever the end thing is, where like he gets to choose fucking Adam and Eve, essentially, but with like 18 dudes and 16 women or whatever, 32, whatever the magic number was, that was like, restart Zion and then we'll reboot the Matrix. Like, he's just gonna go through and unplug people and say like, this is your life now and it fucking sucks, but guess what, you want to stick something in the back of your head, you can, and then you could go back in there and see how cool it is, like, right? What was the selection process before that? There's too many questions about the Matrix, the movie, I think, for there to be the idea for me of the Matrix being the simulation's way of telling me, yeah, there's a simulation. But like,
Wachowski
and it would seem like
could have more karate, so.
Yeah. And like the Animatrix and Path of Neo and all that stuff definitely seem like this is the way to make money. So I don't know how simulation heavy
was
that
the is. Path of Neo, the one where at the end they're like, oh, by the way, we wanted to have Smith merge up into like a bunch of one big giant Smith, and he fights
and you fight
a
as
big
giants,
thing.
Yeah.
And I was
I
like,
don't know what that
but
is.
They stopped the game.
But the Animatrix
right?
was
they
sick.
Stop it and they address you, the player, and
they
say,
address
like,
you as a player. It's
this is like,
yeah.
We really wanted to do it, but we spent way too much money and they wouldn't let us, so we couldn't. But we're going to give it to you now in the game. And I remember thinking, like, thank fucking God you ran out of money, because this would have sucked. Like, this idea of him beating up a giant fucking Agent Smith would have been like so
stupid.
Not cathartic of an ending. It would have just been like, hey, I got fucking $40 million extra dollars. Let's make this. Okay,
got to
cool.
say that the Animatrix might have been a big way of making money, but the writers and artists that they put on it managed to make a kick-ass project. I loved it.
Oh, yeah, Animatrix
was
great.
It was
yeah.
better than 2 and 3 put together.
2 and 3 have grown on me.
Yeah, they're okay.
I did not like them
I
originally.
Two more. When
two.
I watched it last time.
Two, I was a senior in high school and I saw it with my friends and we were so pumped all year to go watch it. We're like, this is gonna be fucking awesome. And me and my friend Taylor went to go see it. And the only thing I get in like the whole experience afterwards was a bad day period. The first time I ever got jumped was that day. Directly after watching the Matrix 2.
So, like, to make the Matrix more realistic for you.
Really we drive the point to, like, home.
We were trying to contemplate
the real world sucks.
We were trying to contemplate our thoughts. Like, we're sitting in this park, we're gonna smoke weed with our friends, and me, Robert, and Taylor are just kind of like, was that good? And then I just go, dude, I don't think I like Zion. And Taylor was like, no, we were in Zion for way too long. And then my friend Pete rolls up, and immediately after he rolls up, we're going to smoke weed. My friends Pete and Casey and Nate, this other car follows him, and the only thing I describe is a gorilla of a man jumps out and starts screaming at my friends, did you just flip me off? And this guy is huge. Man. He looks like a jacked out MMA fighter. Who had the same car as our friend Mark, when my friend Pete stupidly flipped him off thinking it was Mark, very quickly, not Mark. And this guy proceeded to beat the shit out of Pete and Nate, jump and punch me and my friend Taylor, and then we all had to go back to my home, kind of like smoke weed and calm down. So it was like Matrix, did I like it, to getting punched by a huge gorilla. So I like didn't even get to process the movie. I was kind of just like shaking on the ground like,
that's
why?
A like, 1-2 punch, because watching the Matrix 2 for the first time feels like you're getting punched by a gorilla.
And I have a dad bod now, but I was a skinny emo kid back then. I was not big, and I was just like, I'm gonna get my ass kicked. It was like, he like punched me once, and then he was like, you wanna fight? You got your hands up. And I immediately, I'll admit, I was a pussy.
You're
I went,
just covering
I
your
don't
face.
Wanna fight.
Oh, but you put your hands up.
No, like, because this is not gonna be a fight, my friend. This is not gonna be a fight. You're just gonna whip my ass. Please don't, sir. And I later in the last like 5 years, I've rewatched the whole trilogy and I've found a deeper appreciation of what they were trying to do just because it's so crazy. And the fact that they got given hundreds of millions of dollars and that's what they did with it. Instead of making like a straight up sequel that's just bigger, they really tried to go crazier and really kind of expand what the Matrix was. I can really appreciate that. I appreciate the Merovingian too. Yeah, it's definitely ambitious. I know not everyone loves them, but I like the Wachowskis. I would say that, what's it called?
No, they're great.
I'm going to say it's one of my favorite movies, and I can't even think of what it's called.
Jupiter Ascending.
No, not Jupiter Ascending. The one
well,
right
you
before
can't
that,
say that
on
they're your favorites. And
I like Jupiter Ascending, though. I think it's kind of wacky, but the Tom Hanks one, why am I freezing on it right now?
Cloud Atlas.
Well, yeah, Cloud Atlas I love. I think that movie's very moving. Yeah, I love that movie. Have you seen Cloud Atlas, Elle?
You know what? I've read the book. I haven't watched it yet.
I haven't read the books. I'm the opposite. I heard the book's very good, too. But I really did enjoy the movie.
Before we move away from The Matrix, do y'all think that the John Wick movies are actually just a way to keep Neo contained? Like, they were too afraid of Neo coming back right away, so they put him into the John Wick reality? And this is just, like, a Matrix that's running where he's, like, unfucking killable and whoops a bunch of ass even though he's old?
Maybe. I still haven't watched them. We were supposed to watch them and then we never did that episode. We still gotta
watch all the John Wick movies.
Me either. I haven't seen any of them. We'll do it now. We'll bring you on. But
I love them.
My husband likes them.
Just
so
shut your brain off.
I'm like, let me go do something while you're watching. Oh, okay.
Yeah. But not at the same time because there's this really weird. It's a lot like The Matrix, where the longer you look at it, the more you start thinking about how does that world really work?
True.
Like, how does it... What really happens in the next frame? Like, they have these gold coins that they exchange for, like, services, and there's no real determined value to it. It's just, like, reputation, I guess, when you give somebody a coin. Oh, you're badass, you got one of these. But then, like, at the same time, there's another scene where they show one of the guys, like, minting the coin. He's like inspecting it, like, this batch looks good, and the guy takes it away. So like there has to be some real actual value to it that they never explore, but is like a story waiting to be told, right? Like,
well, aren't they doing,
there's
like
just a lot of lore
about
that world. I want
the continental. Yeah
that's gonna come out when all the movies are done, and it's not gonna, like, it's gonna be like the Game of Thrones prequel. Like, nobody gives a shit now because they're going to make John Wick 4 and it's going to, like, suck ass or something. It's going to just be miserable. And then, like, the Continental will come out, and it's like, it could be the best show ever, but it doesn't fucking matter, because after that, I'm not going to watch it.
What happened?
I'm not going to watch Game of Thrones prequel after Game of Thrones.
Did John Wick make Keanu Reeves think he's a god? Because I...
What happened with me is I went and visited my dad for his 50th birthday, and, like, stayed at his house for, like, 2 days. And I was like, hey, I haven't seen John Wick 2. And he's like, what? You haven't seen John Wick 2? You know there's John Wick 3, right? And I was like, what the fuck? And watched both.
My grandma's this way too. My grandma loves these movies.
Mind blown. They were awesome.
Yeah, my grandma loves John Wick. An 85-year-old thinks they're like the coolest my dad's ever. He's always like, another John Wick's coming. Does it make him think he's a god, though? Because just this week, as the trade came out, I caught up and read Berserker finally. I read the first issue originally. I'm a big Matt Kent fan, so I'm like, I'm going to read this. Mm-hmm. I started to really enjoy it when it stopped, because it's only 4 issues the first run. I was like, okay, this is going places. But the first few issues, there's so much of just him brutally murdering people. And then right after I read it, he did an announcement today that he's making a movie and an anime show with Netflix, and he's going to star in it, and Matt Kent's going to be involved and all that stuff. And I'm just like, you're really just going to be killing hundreds of people on screen?
Oh, man, I hope so. I'm like a unashamed Berserker fan. I know a lot of people don't like it. And then this last issue, was it number 5 that came out? Oh, yeah, they're doing a live action and an anime. No, it's a comic right now, but
they're doing a movie.
And I'm all in.
I did like it.
Yeah.
If you like Berserker, you'll like John Wick, because it's kind of the same, but without the, like, the Deadpool healing factor.
Yeah.
It really grew on me, like, the mythology they kind of do in his whole past. Like, I only read the trade, so I'm in the 5th issue, but the beginning, it was kind of hard. I liked, like, the stuff with the doctor and kind of them being in Washington, but, like, the first few missions was really brutal for me and kind of hard for me to connect with.
I was surprised how brutal it was, because it was Keanu.
It's so brutal.
I was like, not Keanu, not baby Keanu.
He's just crushing people's heads and shit. And
but then when they do that
ripping hearts out.
Was it issue 3 maybe or 2 where they talk about his parents? That one was like so good. And then this last issue, they kind of explore his relationship with love over the different eras and stuff. And it was such a good issue.
That sounds good. I would say the flashbacks definitely brought me in. Like his parents' story and how his not real father kind of used him as a war weapon. And definitely, like, when the 4th issue ended, when the psychologist goes to his house, I was then invested and was like, I definitely want to finish this. It, like, it ends in that way to keep you wanting to read more, for me at least. I was like, I want to know what she came to go tell him about, like, immediately. I was like, I want to know what they're talking about.
And I think
about.
It's a planned, what, 12 issue? And I hope they ended 12, at 12.
Yeah.
I don't think this is a story that needs to continue past 12 issues. If they do, it's just a cash grab, because this absolutely can be resolved, like, within 12.
Yeah, I think that's the plan. I think what he was saying today, it's going to be the 12 issues, and then it's going to be the movie, and then anime series, and they're all going to be kind of different takes, but with the same story and rules, but different, like, you know, because you have 80,000 years to work with, you can kind of do a lot of different stories in that time with people's different version of B's life. But... after the con talk, because I do want to go into one more thing with Elle, I said I wanted to bring up. Go ahead, Jack.
So is this just like Wolverine with Keanu Reeves as a mass murderer?
No, he's good. He's a soldier, but
soldiers that are extremely effective are just mass murderers for the government.
But he's Keanu, though.
I mean, he does have a conscience.
He's not
a broad stroke.
He is kind of
when he's a kid.
He was learning, though. He didn't know if he could do it or not. You gotta test it.
I love Elle's defense of mass murderers. Like, it's Keanu, though. It's okay.
Just exploring his talents.
He is an extremely murderous Wolverine, but it's Keanu.
Well, he was raised that way.
But he's adorable.
He has his little beard. He's scruffy.
You know what? He holds sandwiches and sits on benches and looks like he's contemplating existence.
He's not attractive. When he's like, reanimating his body parts, that's kind of gross. but why'd you kill him in the first place? You guys are mean. Stop being mean.
We keep on pulling the craziest guest for this show. Maybe we should just try Keanu for Berserker. You want to come on and talk about Berserker? Sure. All right.
And only ask him about the cute parts. Like, you remember that scene?
Remember when they drew you with that scruffy beard? Do you keep that in real life normally, or is that just for roles? You clean shaven, guy?
You're clean shaven.
You like a little bit of scruff?
He's kind of stuck with his beard now, though, huh? Because now it's a part of his persona. Like, he kind of has to keep it for a while.
I think it really helps keep the, like, shape of his face, too. And that sounds probably meaner than I think I wanted it to.
Oh, no, if beards are socially acceptable for women, I absolutely would grow one. Because it's not fair that you guys can just hide your chins. Well, and whether, like, how many chins you have, like, you could just grow a beard and hide all of that. That's
They're
not
really
fair.
Uncomfortable, though.
That's what this is all. This is all camouflage.
Michael feels me. He's been trying to
Jack shaved his beard, so we're not three bearded men. I can't. My wife won't let me shave it. I did it once, and she got very upset.
My husband shaved. I'm reporting him because...
Yeah, no, she won't let me do it again. I was the worst. I did it when we were having our daughter, and I came back to the hospital and shaved, and she
oh, not her,
shaved.
Not the baby never, looking never at you again. For the
well,
first
yeah,
time.
Well, yeah, that's the worst time to do it. Yeah.
I had time alone. I went, time to go.
Now's my chance.
It's going to be on Netflix, but before I use this as a cut-in, everyone should read Turncoat. It's fantastic. It's definitely... a brilliant tale about kind of the nature of humanity and how we all turn on each other. The art from Artyom Trakanov and Jason Wardy is absolutely brilliant. It's one of my favorite Pachnidel books. Like, really, for me, this book and Red Fork are probably my two favorites at this time. I really love Giga, too, but I love all of Alex's work, but it stands high with me. Do you guys have any final thoughts you want to go on Turncoat?
No, I'm excited to hear where this Netflix lead-in is going.
I'm a huge fan of Mike Flanagan. I know Elle watched the show for me. Me and my wife are big Mike Flanagan fans. We were really excited for Midnight Mass. We watched it all last week in a few days, and it's, I think, Mike Flanagan's best work. And it's also a project he's been working on for 20 years. If you go back to his older films, Midnight Mass is a book and a screenplay, actually in his older projects, kind of being brought up. And it's a story of this small town, Crockett Island, where Riley is our main character. Well, he starts off the story, Riley, and he accidentally killed a girl drunk driving. He was in jail for 4 years, and he's returning to his small island town. And at the same time, he returns, this their Monsignor, the priest they've all had their entire lives on the small island, went to basically Jerusalem on like a journey that they all send him to, and he's supposed to come back. But instead of him coming back, this young priest named Paul comes back, played by Hamish Linklater, who's absolutely phenomenal in this show. He's fucking great. He's a great actor. I've always liked him, and I really like that he really gets to do a lot in this series. And miracles start happening in the town. There's a girl who's paralyzed and she gets to walk again, and basically it creates this religious revival on this small island, and it's all because of something you wouldn't think. And there's lots of twists and turns. Neither of you have watched it yet, right, Jack or Chaz?
No, I watched it.
You watched it? So I mean, to me, it was just so well done. Jack, I'm probably gonna spoil stuff right now without you. Sorry, I don't know if you've watched it yet, so you maybe want to mute us, or you're gonna have to edit this anyhow, so it's impossible. So anyhow,
don't mess up.
the meditation it does on religion and kind of human nature and why we're here, I thought was really brilliant. The fact that the V word is never said in the story, and so much of this kind of seems like in this world vampires, they have no idea what they are. And the fact that like religion or religious people like Christians or Catholics can use anything, you know, can turn anything into being words of the Bible. The fact of clear vampirism is then just used as like, you know, notes from the Bible and just showing God's will, instead of being just, you know, clear vampirism. Like, obviously it's not good if you have to drink blood to survive and you want to feast on other humans, but then using the words of the Bible to kind of justify it kind of shows to how bad the Bible has been used in like taking Jesus's words, or, you know, taking the Old and New Testament to do awful things kind of in the name of God, and how easy they can turn that into acts of God with like really no basis on it. And I just really enjoyed the twists and turns too. Like episode 5 really punched me in the gut, like episode 4 did too. And like the end speech from Kate Siegel, I think, was brilliant. And it really reminds me kind of like very much of a holistic living. Now we are all one thing, and we are the universe, you know, kind of experiencing itself. And I thought it was just a profound ending with something so surrounded by religion, and then a completely different take on what we are in our existence, and kind of the fact that we all kind of remember that we're all one in all the universe just experience self, especially in death, I thought was really moving. For me, it's Mike Flanagan's best work. I really think that the characters are well built. I really enjoyed Riley and Kate's character, Aaron, as well. I mean, just everyone was great. I really enjoyed, though, spoiler is, Paul is actually John Pruitt. He's actually the original priest, but he's turned young by vampire blood. And I really loved Hamish Linklater kind of like acting like someone else. But I called it. I called it like episode two. I was like, that's the priest and he's young. Just because you could tell he cared about all these people and it wasn't his first time meeting them, especially, you know, his relationship with Riley. And I love that when he reveals it to Riley, he tells him the story about Riley bringing that mouse to him when he was a kid. And then Riley just being blown away because how would he know that story? But I was blown away. Elle was saying she had conversations with her husband about it all night after they finished it. It's definitely still lingers in my mind right now. And I think it's the best thing Netflix has had on their series, whatever you want to call it, on the actual streamer for years.
I tried to block out some of
you should.
Saying,
it's great. So
spoil it. And now I need to watch
that's good.
It before
I spoil
I
a lot of
so
things.
Have,
but
like,
what were
2 days?
What were your plenty guys' thoughts on it, though? Or how did you judge it up to his other projects, like his haunting projects and his movies?
I think I liked it. I'm more of a Hill House fan personally, just because
that's my wife too.
Content
yeah.
wise, like I can identify more with the themes in Hill House, the you know childhood trauma, the you know sudden deaths, the addiction, all that stuff. So I really like, if I'm gonna cry, I'm gonna put on Hill House. Like if I'm in that kind of mood, Hill House is like top notch. Midnight Mass. See, I didn't grow up like religious. My dad wasn't really religious, so I never really had like a connection with that. So when my husband, he actually didn't watch the first episode. So second episode, I'm watching it, I think it was the second one. And when there's a scene where he heals, you know, I forget the girl's name. And she stood up, and I was like bawling. Yeah. I was like, "Oh my gosh, this is religion, right?" And then when they show him in the tombs, and they see the creature, and my husband was like, "What's that?" I'm like, "Oh, it's an angel." Like just me being ignorant, because I'm like, "Okay, I'm going along," because I didn't make the connection yet. And I was like, "I guess that's what angels look like in this world." And then finally I'm like, and they, you know, they do like the bite or whatever. And I was like, oh shit, Midnight Mass, because it's midnight. Yeah. And like, it never occurred to me during production. And like, I am a big Mike Flanagan fan. Like I love all of his work. So I had been keeping up with this for some time. It did not occur.
I had
to
no
me
idea it was about vampires
time.
Either.
And so when he said that, I had to pause it. And I was like, Midnight Mass, you stupid. Like, I felt so dumb because I was like, how obvious with the title. And so that really took me out. But
I can see that catching you by surprise, kind of.
Yeah, I did. It just wasn't like, and then most of his other work, well, I guess his Netflix work has been mostly ghosts. And like true. human hauntingness, like emotions and stuff like that. So
right.
Wasn't expecting. Yeah. So when I saw the angel, I was like, oh, is this an angel for real or is it in his head? And then it was like, oh no, this is like straight up. It is what it is. Take it for what they're saying it is. And I think that kind of relates back to religion too.
Yeah. I liked the show. I thought it was pretty good, but I didn't love all of it necessarily. Like I really like the idea of dressing up sort of this old tale in a new way, or really embracing sort of the horror of the Bible. Like I think I could also say safely that I did not grow up religious, right? Like we attended churches occasionally whenever our parents got like the wild hair or whatever to relieve themselves of their sins, or I don't know, whatever people go to church for. So there's a lot of scary, gross, creepy stuff when you take it out of the context of, oh no, but it's coming from a place of love, you know, like it's coming from a god up there that cares. So, like, even though it's scary because you don't know it, it's okay because, like, you know that it's good. So, like, just the way that evil can be embraced by, like, the virtue of the good that they feel, it's okay. I don't feel anything, so it's, like,
all right. And the eagerness for it.
Right. They were, like, that part is cool.
They were hungry for that.
Especially Bev, who's fucking...
But you can also see, like, there's pain in the fact that he lost his congregation, like, when Bev lets them all out, or whatever. Like, that shit, when he comes up and he's like, you let him out, and she's like, of course. He's just like, well, it's over now. Like, he knows, like, there's no point in continuing on, because there's no reining these people in now that they've embraced this bloodlust.
And then he immediately sees what's actually important in that moment, too. And then when he gets to admit to his secret love that the only reason he did it all was because he wanted to come back and give her a chance, you know, with them to be together.
And that's where he damns himself. So it's it's really good, but it felt like at times it just kind of like dropped the ball for me. Like, there were a few times where I was like, I really like when the priest and Riley are having their like their one-on-one AA meetings. Like, there's a lot of really cool discussion going on. And then they would cut back to this other stuff, and I'd be like, I don't really care about Riley and Aaron getting together. Like,
yeah, some of those monologues need this were CW a little shit. Long-winded, especially pertaining to them, especially given how short the season is and how much time. I felt like that didn't have to be explored necessarily.
No, I would have liked seeing him and the new father growing closer, working together more, him trying to, like, I'm not back in the church, but I have to do community service or some other, like, parole shit that he's like, oh, yeah, we'll do it together. I would have liked to see more of that back and forth, and then the slow revelation of, like, oh, fuck, you know a lot more about, I never told you that story or something, right? Like, that would have been more rewarding than, like, oh, yeah, he's going to go tell Aaron his big revelation about, like, guilt and all this other, like, I don't know. There's just a few times where, like, thematically the show didn't fit the bill for
maybe
me.
Guys,
but it really I made up for it in others. So
yeah, I definitely enjoyed Riley and Paul's, or Riley and John, whatever you want to call them's relationship a lot more than him and Aaron's. Though I did really enjoy their conversation about death.
Oh yeah,
I
feel like that other was people so might, good.
That one, like, yeah, that one was just floored me and my wife, just because it was so great to hear. And then especially the way it plays out in the end for me. I mean, for me, not surprising to talk about that much, but I was raised with Christians and hippies. So, I mean, like, that was which I think kind of fits well in the series, because it kind of goes from Christian to a big hippie monologue at the end.
If you haven't watched it yet, so this is kind of a spoiler, but him dying, I didn't realize what the show was about yet. So when he has that seizure, and I was like, it wasn't until after the show was over, and I was like, oh shit, Bev killed him.
Yeah, she was poisoning
him. And I didn't realize
it
until, like, after the show was over, because I had already had it in my head for some reason, like, oh, well, we don't really see him out and about anyway. So I just thought it was, like, slow to take effect, like, the turn.
Yeah.
No, like, she killed him, and I was like, wow, I knew I didn't like you, but, like, now afterwards, I really...
And he knew afterwards, that's why he wouldn't take the soup. Not only, well, he also wanted blood then, but I think he also knew that she was poisoning him in his soup. It's definitely a show I think people will get different reactions out of. It's definitely, to me, guys, freaking love it or like it, something of a high quality on Netflix, where I feel like a lot of their stuff. I mean, everyone's talking about Squid Game now. My wife just watched the whole series.
She's pretty good.
I watched it in one sitting, and I'm not.
She didn't like a day two.
Yeah, it's worth it.
She said it was great. Yeah, I will jump on the crazy train. When I was at work on Microsoft Teams, it's crazy because now, like, half our GIFs are all Squid Game. No. Like, I'm like, wow, this shit worked.
I watched clickbait in one day, but it was bad.
Oh, clickbait? That looks bad.
It was, like, bad in a good way, you know what I mean? Like, it's so awful that it's, like, compelling.
That's the one with the guy from Entourage, right?
Yeah, and it plays exactly the same kind of jackass character that you don't want to root for. And so it's, like, but I watched it in one sitting because I was, like, I don't know if I'm really bored or if I'm just, like, it's, like, mindless entertainment. And then there's like a twist that like shouldn't be a twist because it makes it awful. Like, this is a pretty bad show. And then the twist happens and you're like, oh wow, I can't believe I sat here for, it is clickbait in a way, because I sat here for 8 hours and watched this entire show.
I'm just not a big Entourage. I feel like it's a test. Like, there's a new coworker at my work that keeps on the video chats, keeps on having Entourage as his background. And I think I was the only person being like, really? And then like the other day at a meeting, one of our other coworkers was like, is that Entourage? And they're like, great show. And he's like, it's my favorite show, man.
That's a red flag.
Not to be rude, but I immediately, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. As soon as he said that, I went, I don't think we could hang out, man. I don't think we could be friends.
You didn't come in with the turtle? Oh, yeah. In the background.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. I can't do that showing on for like 6 seasons.
Yeah, so, Squid Game, I'm not going to lie, it's like the 10,000th deadly game thing to come out of Asia in the last year. So I could not get behind it. I got really bored like 2 episodes in. Not going to lie, hot take.
Hot take.
Yeah, that is.
It's the most popular show in the world, so you are in the small market.
It's the most popular show in the world, but it still wasn't good.
I think it was like the first couple episodes, like I had to get into it.
I watched like 5.
And then once I... Okay, well.
My little brother wanted me to watch it with me. Yeah, it is a real hot take. Yeah, it's just a tired, played out cliche. That's all it is. Yeah, exactly.
Get them talking.
Let them all.
You know what it is, but I kind of like. It's. I think in terms of like American entertainment, it was refreshing because it was different from what America entertainment is feeding us. Like, and so like the melodramas, the CW stuff. Like, I don't want to see that right now. Like, give me something a little bit more. And I think...
Give me something reflective of the American experience. Being in a lot of debt and being willing to die for a lot of money. Yeah. Do I got to kill for it? Maybe. I might.
Yeah. That is truly the American experience.
It's for the fun of the ultra wealthy? Seems like life. Yeah.
I have like a... Yeah. I'm really into like K-dramas and like Korean horror movies and stuff. So like...
Me
so
too.
Like, Squid Game was like, I'm gonna be into it regardless. I'm not gonna act like I'm not gonna be.
So I'm a diehard Chan-Wook Park fan. So you think I would like it? Chan-Wook Park, who did like Old Boy.
No, for sure.
Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. Yeah, yeah, I love him. He has a new movie coming out soon. I always watch his stuff. Well, this was a great Netflix diatribe. Real quick, you guys want to go into what you're reading right now or what you read last week? I want to shout out Party and Pray by Steve Fox and Steve Orlando. I should have grabbed the picture because now I think it's Alex Sanchez and Juan Cho, who I think had a... Hold on, I'm going to go back. We're going to cut back on this so that I don't misread any of these people that made this book. I really enjoyed. Real quick...
I haven't really had a chance to read anything apart from this stuff to be ready for the episode. So I still got to catch up on, like, Once in Future, which I know a new one of that just dropped.
Coolest thing I read lately was Limbo. That was dope.
It was pretty cool, yeah.
But Party and Pray by Steve Fox and also Steve Orlando and by... Alex Sanchez and also Juan Cho is just, it's going to be in my top of the year. I'm just saying. Oh yeah, by the way, guys, we're going to have Elle come back for our best of the year books, so we get a third person in there, because Jack and I usually don't have time to read books, so we get to talk about our top books. But I think this is going to rank high for me. I know Elle read it too, but for me, the way it just turned the tables on me, because I didn't know much about the story. And what I thought it was about was...
I didn't know anything about it. I just bought it because it was Aftershock, and I knew it was, like, full... Like, I knew... I thought it was a one-shot. I didn't know it was going to be, like, a whole graphic novel. And I had just watched Space Out of Color, Color Out of Space for Pink Buzz. And when I... So I read this, and, like, I had the worst dreams, and, like, Nicolas Cage was Alan in my dream, and I was stuck in a house with him.
Oh, God.
And it was just, like, what the fuck? Like, this is, like, one of my favorite books now. Like, it... Because, like, it doesn't, like, really hit you how full it is until after... Like, you're reading it, it's, like, intense. But then you read, like, the afterword by the Steves.
Yeah,
and it's so good. And I'm just, like, wow, man, like... And then I knew I was probably going to, because I shouldn't read before I go to bed. That's, like, my thing. But, like, oh, man, the worst dreams. And,
yeah, and it's
so good.
That was me after Lonely Receiver.
It's about nights. Real issues. Lonely Receiver is another great mm-hmm. book that will give you.
Oh, mess me up.
Yeah, that Zach Thompson knocking out of the park recently. And I just got Come Into Me, which I'm going to read today, which is one of the earlier books. Which I've heard a lot of good things about. I won a bunch of horror awards, and I knew nothing about it. But it hit me, because I didn't know anything about it, and the actual description for the book is completely a lie. It's like, this old man's taken home from a young, flirty guy. Like, what's going
to
happen?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be, like, a queer party book. Like, I didn't know it was going to be anything more than outside of a club.
And it just switched it on me, like, when, you know, in the beginning, I'm like, are we following Alan and this kid's like a serial killer? And then when you find out what's actually going on, you're so fully with Terry on his journey and Kurt too, that it's just like becomes a survival thriller. And especially the afterword, because it's such an intense experience. It's such a good way to read about it and all these real world issues of, you know, powerful men taking advantage of younger people, and also just, you know, not as bad as Alan with the, no spoiler alert, secret things under his house that are truly horrific. But I mean, it's a great way to kind of attack these issues and also just makes for a thrill ride. It's going to rank high for me. I'm definitely going to wait to talk about it more because it's going to be up there at the end of the year for me, like pretty high. I don't know. I have to go over everything again and reflect, but I definitely think it's going to be up there. And so will The Good Asian, which I finally read, which Chaz has been recommending. And Chaz, hard noir is right. Like, that's the kind of noir I like. Like, Chinatown style fucking noir set in, like, still on huge Asian racism was going on in San Francisco, and me being raised in that area. So for me, it makes me kind of just, you know this stuff existed. Because when you go to schools outside of San Francisco and stuff, you learn about all this horrible shit that we did to the Chinese and the Japanese. And it's horrible, so it's good that we learn about it so these kind of things don't happen again. But just all of Edison Hark's adventure, I just really was invested in. Once again, 4 issues. I had to put the single issues on my pull because that 4th issue ended. I'm like, I gotta fucking finish this story. Like, I know. I was gonna try to trade weight, but then by the end of the 4th issue, I was like, nope, that's not possible. I'm either gonna get this. I don't like the pirates, so I'll just get the singles and buy the trade again, which is kind of my request. Like, I want the singles and then the trade because that's also gonna be high on my list. Like, noir done in that style, straight up, like, you know, Chinatown, like old school noir, not anything too flashy, and just a good story. With real, once again, real world issues kind of weaved in, really works for me. Both great books. Elle, have you read anything besides Party and Prayer that you really want to talk about?
I mean, recently? I read the usual. I did read 10 Years to Death, which I liked too.
That I liked it a lot.
Like when Stephen King was writing his Bachman, it had like big, those kind of vibes. And especially like the short stories. I know a lot of people don't like Reptilian, but I really like Reptilian.
I don't mind Reptilian. The last issue was crazy.
I think the message is like lost, because I think a lot of people are reading it like serious, and to me it's satire. And I'm like, especially with like the beginning of number 4, where he's like fat people, and I'm like, how can you guys read this and think like this is like literal? You know what I mean? Like come on, like, even with the revelation in the story, I'm like, how can you take this seriously? Like, it's clearly a joke, and so it saddens me that a lot of people dropped it after the first issue because they couldn't get into the art style and stuff. And I was like, no, but the story is, and I love the art in it, so it's one of my favorite short minis this year. And then I did read the new issue of Crossover, which I liked. And Gun Honey, number 1, I enjoyed. I know a lot of people don't like Batman 89 either. And I've
been reading that. Yeah, that's awesome.
And so I think that's mostly.
That's good. You opened eyes for me. I don't even know what Gun Honey is, so I'll have to look into it. And I've been enjoying Reptilian too. I really like 10 Years of Death, and it's fucking crazy. It's written by Chief from Battlestar Galactica. I didn't realize he's had like 3 books out from Aftershock. Like, I just kept seeing Aaron Douglas, and I was like, why does that name seem familiar to me? And it was funny because like 2 weeks ago, me and my wife were watching the whole Final Destination series, and he's in Final Destination 2 as like a cop, and he's super young. And I was like, that's Chief from Battlestar Galactica. And she's like, who? And I was like, oh, this guy. And then like 2 weeks later, I'm reading this, and I was like, you're here again. Once again, we've crossed paths, Aaron Douglas. And it's crazy that's based on like a real story his great uncle told his dad. And I thought he did a very good job and had serious King vibes for me as well. Yeah, those are all great books you guys should all read. I'm really excited for tomorrow because we got Out from AWA. We got the fourth issue of Nice House on the Lake where you're going to fucking realize they're on a UFO. And you're going to realize it because it's about the astronomer, and she's going to say something about the stars, which is in the previews, which is going to be her going, we ain't fucking on Earth, guys, which I thought the last one had such a great revelation. And, you know, really excited for Arkham City. So pumped for that. So pumped to talk with Dan about it next week. And that'll be hitting you guys next Wednesday. So we got Dan coming on next Friday, actually. Or Jack, are we going to... Did he leave?
Yeah, he stepped away for a minute.
All right. Well, next week, you guys will have our episode with Dan Waters. We're very excited to have him on. We're going to be talking about Arkham City, Order of the World, and some of his other books. And then the week after that, we have Alex coming on, and Johnny himself, who we shouted out earlier, is coming on for our 50th episode, which is a big, big milestone for us. And we're going to talk about Alex's Avengers book coming out, Death of Doctor Strange Avengers. We're going to talk about Tales of Terrors, which is coming out from TKO. And we're going to talk about the Giga trade, which is coming out in November. So a lot of cool stuff. And we'll probably go into our crazy tangent with Alex again and talk about a bunch of shit that isn't any of that. But we're excited to have them back on. Elle, we're going to have you back on for Department of Truth in a few weeks as well, which I'm really excited to talk about that. That last issue knocked it out of the park for me. I don't know if you read it yet, but...
Oh, no, I was saving it because I knew I was going to reread the whole thing. So I have it, but I haven't read it yet.
In the trade, I'm getting too, so I can reread it again. There's a crazy twist at the end, and I got to say, Hawk is one of my favorite characters of the year. If I could do an award for the end of the year for best character, it's Hawk Harrison. He's great. I hope we get lots more of him throughout this series, which seems like it doesn't have any endpoint, which I'm glad about. And then
best definitely good guy,
check
best
out you guys
guy.
Pink Bus new this categories. Friday. Yeah, he's kind of good bad, so I don't know. I feel like put that's gonna be hard to classify Hawk in, but definitely this Friday, you guys check out Pink Bus because John Lee's the wonderful author of Sync and also Mountain Head is coming on to talk about his new books, The Crimson Cage and Hotel Volume 2. Hotel's another great book he did, and they're going to release it on Friday. I know I'm going to be watching it because I fucking love John Lee's, and I'm really excited to see them jam with him. Elle, do you have anything you want to promote? I know that you're on Pink Buzz a lot, and I think you are on some other podcasts as well, right?
Yeah, I have a podcast called Here We Connect, and I think that's the same at on Twitter. I don't do the logistics. I just show up. And then... Yeah, I've been on...
That's the way to go. Let me tell you.
Like, no, because the person I podcast with, Saint, he edits everything, and he sent me like a California Valley rough cut of every time I say or like, and I did not appreciate that at all. So, and then, yeah, I go on Pink Buzz, and then I've done House of Nerds, so I'm around.
Awesome. And now you get the chance because Jack edits us all in jazz music. So now there's a very good chance you're going to be featured on a track one day.
Us and our guests in the tunes. My new one's got Michael and Kevin Radatelli. Kevin told me that he's really excited to be in my music, so I don't feel weird about using him at all. I actually feel stoked about it.
Anyway, Elle, I said your tag earlier, but where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter at Not Exactly Legit. And everywhere else at Not Exactly Legit, but I'm not as active as on most active on Twitter.
And you can find me guys as always on Twitter at PoetAir33. You can find the show at Outside The with a zero instead of an O. And then where can they find you, Jack and Chaz?
You can find me on Twitter as well at Chaz Simons.
You can find me at Sin_Aesthetics with an X on Twitter and Instagram. And check out those new hypnotic visualizers on Spotify. All right.
And what is collaborative geometry? To lead us off of the show, I'm going to say, whoa. Chaz?
Turn the page.
That was a bad Keanu.
And wash your hands.
Pages.